great to have masterclass. Get to learn some new things that are not even within the areas, you know, that you might be working on. It's just like new stuff, new people. I think that's what's so great about it. So I may share this and we will get started. Is it recording? Yes, we are. This one. Okay, can everybody see the screen?
No, I cannot.
But James, you can see it. And Frank
Yes,
can
I
see
can.
it. Okay, so some people do, so it might be just on its way to coming up. Sorry, this is taking a minute. I have to reshare. Try it again. Okay. Okay, let's get started.
Hi, my name is Angelica. So Google Suite consists of free cloud computing programs that's powered by Google. And then all of the programs can be accessed through a web browser or downloaded on apps on either iOS or Android. And then some of the programs that's on there are Gmail, Calendar, Google Meets, Sheets, Google Docs, Slides, Chat, and then Drive. To use the programs in Google Suite, it's free, but you need to have a Google account in order to do that. So here I'm showing you how to create that account. So you would go to whatever search engine you're using, and then I just enter Gmail, and then so it'll be the first, it should be the first one that comes up, but what you should click on is the one that says Gmail email from Google. And then from there, it'll take you to the next image where in the bottom left corner, you can select create an account. And then it'll give you a few options of who you're creating the account for. You have the option of for myself, for my child, or to manage my business. And then after you select what you're creating it for, you will select next. But for the purposes of this one, I selected myself. So after you select who you are creating the account for, it'll take you to this first image where you begin to create your account. You enter your name, and then you enter the username that you would like, which will be your Gmail, like your email account. And then if the name you selected is free, then you'll get a green check mark, I believe it is, and then you can just proceed. But if it's taken, it'll let you know that, and then it'll like bring up some suggestions underneath it. And then you create your password, and then you move on to the next page. And then you enter some more information. And then under gender, they of course have male, female, rather not say, and then they have custom, and then you know you can select what you want from there. And then at the bottom, this hyperlink, why we ask for this information, they provide you with information with, of course, why they ask for it if you care to know. And then here is the last step in creating your account. You just have to agree to the privacy and terms, and then I didn't scroll all the way down to show you where you would agree to it. But I mean, you would just scroll through and read this. And at the bottom, you would select, I agree. So after you agree to the privacy and terms, you'll be taken to this screen, which is your Gmail account. And then you have your first welcoming email from Google. And then of course you can see on the left, you can compose an email. Then you have your different folders. You can search for emails at the top after you start getting more. And then at the top right corner is where you can access the other programs in that dotted square where the red arrow is pointing. But before we get to that part, at the bottom, I guess more so to the left side of the screen, it shows us you have 1 gigabyte of data to use. So the first one I selected was Calendar, and here it helps you like stay really organized by allowing you to see everything you have scheduled. You can also like color coordinate different things that I didn't show but I should have. But you can color coordinate different meetings or whatever you have on your calendar to help you stay organized as well. So you can schedule events, meetings, you can search for people, and then you can see where you can search for people on the left-hand side in the middle where I have the red arrow pointing. This is more beneficial, I think, for like businesses because I'm pretty sure unless somebody's calendar is publicly available, like you can't just search anybody's calendar on the free version. And then you can also. So before we get to this screen, what you need to do on the previous screen is double click anywhere on the calendar in order to add a meeting or event. And then so you will add the title, and this is what people will see if you are going to invite anybody to this meeting in their email. That's what they'll see. And then if they opt to select it, you know, this is what they'll see on their calendar and what you will see on your calendar as well. And then underneath that, you have the start date, start time, the end time, and the end date. And then you can select on these to change them as you need to. And then you can also add a video link if you need to. And then you can add a physical location if you wanted to as well. You can also opt for the notifications. And then you can like color coordinate it as well if you need to. Right next to my name, there's a blue circle. You can click on that drop down and then change it to whatever color you need it to be. And then you can also add the description. And then to the right, you can see this is where you will be adding guests if that's what you want to do for this meeting. So here we have Google Docs, and this is a word processor where you can create documents, upload them, edit them, share them, and some other things. I feel like it's pretty comparable to Microsoft Word, but the basic version, so maybe I shouldn't have said that. But it will get the job done nonetheless. And then they also have like templates that I've actually used before to get my current job in my third interview that they didn't even look over what I created, but whatever. So they have like some useful things here with the templates. And then at the bottom here, I showed you some of the options that they have. Like when you actually click on a blank document or any of the documents you can click on, some of the editing options that they have, similar to Word, but like I said, just not as extensive. So here is Google Sheets, and it's like the very basic version of Excel. You can basically use it, you know, as a calculator. You can use it to create lists, budgets, and pretty much like anything else with like numbers. But there were like some interesting things that I've done with Excel before, like creating like different images, like not just graphs, that I thought I'll be able to do here, but I cannot because, you know, like I said, it is like the very basic version. And here is actually where I thought I was going to come and blow everybody's minds away with what I could do in Sheets, because I know what I can do in Excel, even as like a basic, you know, user of Excel, but I do not know how to do that, or I can't do it here, at least from what I know. So, yeah. Thank you for bearing with me through this presentation. Like I said in the beginning, I feel like I chose the wrong degree. So it was kind of hard for me to figure out of everything that I learned, what do I feel like I could explain, you know, well. And I changed my mind a million times before I did this and obviously ended up on this, and it was a bad decision. But I do appreciate the internship for allowing me to get more clarity on you know, where I feel like I would rather be, where I think I fit better as opposed to analytics. So thank you for that. Thank you for all of your help and your time. And yeah, that's it for me. Bye.
Well, I think she did a great job. Yeah, I think so too. I think she did a great job. I know it's hard to decide on what to do. I've had a few people that were having trouble deciding on what to present. And like I said, present anything. We appreciate anything. There might have been some people who don't know a lot about Google, things that you can use on Google. So All right, so our next person in line to present is Day.
All right, yes, how's it going, everybody? Glad you're all here. I'm going to go ahead and present this presentation here on Wireshark. I guess I should probably share my screen first. That'd probably be a good idea. Let's do this real quick. Okay, can everyone see this all right?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah, let's go ahead and get started. So I just want to forewarn, did have some background noise. I did my best to try and minimize it, but just bear with me. Okay. Let's make this full screen here.
If you're speaking, we can't hear anything.
Yes, I'm not speaking. I'm not sure if you guys could hear the sound of the presentation.
But, we cannot.
I'm sorry?
No, there's no sound.
No, I cannot.
Okay, well, that's a problem. We're going to have to go ahead and fix that. My apologies, guys. I had no idea you couldn't hear it. I guess we'll go back to the beginning. How would I do this? Here, let's try this real quick. There we go. Okay, guys, hopefully you all can hear it this time. Sorry about that. Try to go back here. On Wireshark. My name is Delano, and I'm excited to have you all here with me today. Can everyone hear
Welcome
this okay?
To our presentation on Wireshark.
Yes.
My name is Delano, and I'm excited to have you all here with me today. So, with that being said, let's go ahead and take a look at today's agenda. So, first things first, we're going to take a moment to talk about the basics of Wireshark. Much like all software tools, it is critical to establish a foundation of what we're working with before we dive in. Next, let's follow that up with how we actually get started with Wireshark, including where we go to install the program and some of the first things we're greeted with as we open it up. We'll then take it one step further and talk about Wireshark in the context of security, with a focus on adversary investigations with Nmap, unencrypted transmissions, and finally, Log4j as a case study. Lastly, we'll send it out with a bang and open the floor up to any questions. So, if all that sounds good to you, let's take a look at the most common questions I get by far, which is, what is Wireshark? Well, Wireshark is an open source packet sniffer and inspection tool. It's used to capture network traffic from Ethernet, Bluetooth, wireless, and frame relay protocols, just to name a few. Why do we use Wireshark? Well, Wireshark offers cybersecurity professionals like Blue Team Defenders enhanced visibility over the security of their company assets. Visibility is important because it allows company leaders to make more informed business decisions, which in turn helps drive innovation, big picture thinking, and is overall critical for the cultivation of a better cybersecurity posture overall. But let's take a moment to talk about what it isn't. Monitoring for security threats is not a one-sided operation. It is a strategic process that requires other sophisticated tools and equally talented defenders to conclusively document and determine adversary activity. So with all that out of the way, why don't we get into the fun stuff? All right, so first things first, let's take a look at the installation and execution. Very simple here. We just head to wireshark.org. You'll download the appropriate installer for your machine. Download any necessary libraries, such as NPCAP or USBCAP. And then finally, you'll execute wireshark.exe. That's it. You're good to go. Finally, once we've got everything situated, you'll be greeted with this startup screen. But just keep in mind, yours might look different. Now, all that the screen is displaying is that it's the different places where we can capture traffic. You can see which ones are active based on the electrocardiogram-looking feature parallel to the interface name. In my case, I'm going to go ahead and capture on interface EN0. Once doing so, you may or may not notice a surge of new information just flooding the screen, but don't be alarmed. Instead, simply press the red stop button located near the top of the screen to halt the capture. Now, there are quite a few other buttons that we can take a look at here, such as the blue fin button, which will prompt you to save the capture before starting a new one, or the green one, which will simply restart the capture during the recording, removing any previously unsaved packets. Now, this would be a good time to talk about the difference between capture filters and display filters. So a capture filter is set right before the capture. It cannot be changed during the capture. It is generally used for capturing a specific type of traffic. Whereas the display filter is the type of filter to refine the packets during or after the capture itself. It is generally used for hiding non-essential traffic. So now that we've talked about what different filters are available to you, let's take a look at a few examples. As you can see, these are some common capture filters, including filters for IPs, protocols, and host, and likewise for display filters as well. Now, I'd be doing you a disservice if I didn't mention the invaluable statistics tab. This is where Wireshark stores its fast and precise calculations that are made against various important attributes of the collected data. Of course, this is done to save us analysts lots of time. So for instance, let's look at the conversations window. This feature will give you all the information about conversations between two endpoints in your capture. As you can see, it will provide data about the packet lengths, and the time it took to start and end in relation to the capture, and much more. Similar to the conversations window, the endpoints window will instead provide information about specific host. As you can see, this will include data related to transmission and reception on a host. This is great for performance. In my case, I have a database called MaxMindDB installed, and it is configured to provide additional geolocation information of each host, including the autonomous system number, or ASN, and its respective organization. Diving deeper, the protocol history reveals a tree of all protocols and all packets observed within the capture, where each role holds statistical values of each protocol and how many packets actually follow that protocol. However, please note, packets often contain multiple different protocols in one. So if the packet is not 100% just one protocol, Wireshark will break down its ingredients instead. Moving on. So the last one we'll be showing off here is the IPv4/IPv6 statistics window, which will, as the name suggests, reveal in-depth information about the internet protocol version of your choosing. All right, so with all that out of the way, we're going to be taking a look at a very common case of an adversary using Nmap to scan hosts on our network for valuable information. But first, what is Nmap? Nmap, or Network Mapper, is an open source network utility tool which facilitates host discovery and security auditing. Nmap uses raw IP packets in novel ways to determine host information, such as the active services that are running, active operating systems that are running, and even active packet filters or firewalls that are running as well. Okay, so first things first, despite its beautiful neon coloration, there is an attacker actively scanning hosts on our network for information in this screenshot. Let's first find out how we can be confident in this claim, though. Although, just keep in mind, in an ideal security setting, enterprise SOAR and SIEM technology will often alert of and ultimately try to block this from happening. But let's just say that this is happening to keep things simple for now. So first things first, I want to draw your eyes to these highlighted points here, here, and here. First, while source IPs sending packets to one destination IP is not inherently suspicious, the fact that this IP address is actively sending one-handed SYN flags over many different ports at the same time is suspicious. Of course, this is a common example of a SYN stealth scan with the preset Nmap switches. And again, in the next example, we have a case of the same thing. However, this time, the attacker is using Nmap to send various flags in an attempt to discover how the operating system will respond when they receive them. You can see these flags here, down there at the bottom. In this example, we have a common Nmap null scan taking place here. However, this time, the attacker attempted to scan the entire network and find all open ports based on their RST flag reply. And you can see that down there at the bottom. Okay, moving on. Just wanted to take a few moments to talk about another critical security feature of Wireshark. It's called protocol following. I have created two examples for demonstration. In this video, we have a web server on the right called Metasploitable 2, which I briefly connected to for the sake of creating a file called flag.txt and showing its IP address of 192.168.183. Now on the left, I have my MacBook that will attempt to connect to it via Telnet, a notoriously insecure protocol. I demonstrate how someone on the network can view the entire session in plain text by following the TCP stream. Let's watch. Okay, in the next video, we'll be taking this concept to a very insecure and deprecated protocol called HTTP. Like last time, I'll demonstrate how we can use the follow stream feature to observe plain text information. And indeed, you'll notice how I'm able to search for specific strings within this graphical user interface, allowing me to potentially even find sensitive data in no time. Let's watch. We're going to take a look at Log4j. And Log4j is an open source logging framework that allows software developers to log various types of data within their applications. It is part of the Apache Logging Services. Log4j is still used by thousands of websites and applications to enable routine functions, namely logging information, which can be used for debugging and other purposes. Logging is a very critical aspect of software development, and organized logs can offer quick debugging, easy maintenance, and controlled storage of an application's runtime information. So the Log4j vulnerability was classified as CVE-2021-44228. It was also known as Log4Shell and Logjam. It was a zero-day remote code execution vulnerability in the Log4j framework. Threat actors made use of a server that is running the unpatched Log4j software to execute any software that they wanted to, including malware, like ransomware. So I just wanted to create this Log4j attack lifecycle to break down things a little bit further. We have several stages, the recon, delivery, exploitation, installation, and finally the actions on objectives. First, the attacker will sweep the internet for vulnerable Log4j servers. They will go ahead and attempt to send a malicious HTTP request to the server. The exploitation will occur from bad strings and queries to the malicious LDAP server. The attacker will download and execute malicious payloads, and then of course they will enable things like crypto mining or ransomware, remote shells. They'll just do basic data exfiltration, et cetera, et cetera. So this attack map specifically was created with the goal of showing you all how widespread this attack was, but just in relation to the small packet capture that I'm using here for the demonstration. But you can just imagine that on a much larger scale, just how many attackers and defenders were attempting to interact with this vulnerability. Let's go ahead and take a look and see how this works on the packet level. So phase one begins with packet number 444, revealing that an attacker sends a base 64 encoded post request to our server running log4j. In phase two, when we decode the string, we can see that the attacker wants our server to install Linux malware from a known malicious IP address. Now, we know that it's malicious because it has a negative reputation report from VirusTotal.net. We can even compound that information against Yarlhouse, a business dedicated to identifying and reporting command and control malware loading servers. And in phase four, we can obviously check to see if our server responds or beacons out to that specific malicious IP address. But in this case, we're retrieving zero results of that happening. However, in the real world, it would definitely be worth investigating just to make sure that there's no additional penetration. We can use some sort of log analysis technology to ensure that this particular search was not a fluke. That's outside the scope of this presentation. All right, I do hope that that was informative, and I do thank you for sticking around to the end of this presentation. If you do have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me after this recording. Okay, great. Hopefully everyone can still hear me okay. Just a little laggy here at the moment. Hopefully everyone could have seen that. Okay. Stop this real quick. Okay, can everyone hear me okay? Going once, going twice?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
No problem. Good job.
Thank you very much. Hope it was a good presentation. Thanks, guys.
Yep, it was great. Thank you. And then I guess now we have Srinivas.
Yep, shot. Let me share my screen. I hope everyone is able to see my screen and hear me right.
Yes, we can hear you and see your screen.
Yeah, thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Srinivas, and today I will be talking about data analytics, the different types of data analytics, its importance for the within the business community, and I will also demo one of the techniques commonly used in the data analytics. That's the agenda. And I will start right away. So data analytics. Data analytics is a science of analyzing the data in the business to derive meaningful and actionable insights. So, I mean, data analytics it's a bigger process. So there are many things that need to be done before you analyze your data. So data analytics also sometimes involve ingesting the data, gathering all the relevant data. Data cleansing is a bigger part of data analytics because many times incorrect data will actually skew your analytics to one side, which may not be right. So it's very important to make sure that data is cleansed and you have trust on your data before you perform any kind of data analytics. And why data analytics is important. Data analytics is very important because without analytics, you will not know like how your business is performing. So for example, if you want to know, like if you are a company which publishes games or sells games, you would like to know how your users are feeling about your game. Or if you dig a little bit deeper, you'll also want to know like what parts of my game are interesting and which sections of my game are longer and boring for my users. And if you can also see how your game is monetized. So whether the users are buying the stuff that you are putting on the game, like the weapons, all the stuff that you're going to put in for the sell, whether they are buying it or not, you would like to know all that stuff. data analytics is also useful in the supply chain. So for example, supply chain is a good use case. So you'd like to know like how your devices are selling, what part of your, what kind of devices are selling faster so that you can improve your purchasing plans. That's one of the use cases that generally people use. And let's go to types of data analytics. So there are four types of data analytics called descriptive, diagnostic, predictive, and prescriptive. Descriptive analytics is all about understanding your data. So it will tell you like what is happening in your data set. So, I mean, some of the examples would be like, have the numbers of the views gone up? How are the sales looking in the past 6 months? What kind of products are selling faster? These are all descriptive analytics. You just understand the data. And the next level of analytics is diagnostic analytics. Diagnostic analytics talks about, it is pinpoint on what is causing what. So for example, if I am looking at the hospital data, I would like to know like what is making my patients spend more time in ICU. So like, I mean, you can talk about, you can verify that stats of your patients and see like, whether the age is causing them to spend more time in the hospital, or is it like underlying symptoms causing them to spend more time in the hospital? You can all, that's one good example of the diagnostic analytics. The other kind of analytics is predictive. Predictive is like using the diagnostic analytics and understanding and predicting what's gonna happen. So for example, if I want to understand, if I diagnose my sales, will I be able to predict the sales in the future? That's one kind of analysis that we can do in predictive. And the prescriptive analysis is like, what will we do if something happens? So for example, it can lead to a action. So if I'm talking about the same example I listed here, if you're measuring, if you're analyzing the weather patterns, so one such prescriptive analytics would be like, so if my weather is above average, what should I do? Should I actually, in case of this brewery example, should we add an extra shift or should we order more beer into the house? So those are the prescriptive examples. So I have some, in the notes, I also added some of the techniques that we're going to use in these kind of analytics. So for example, all descriptive analysis, we're going to use summary, plots, histograms. These are all kinds of descriptive analytics. So, all of these are, there is underlying statistics and math to it. But when we are using in the actual technology world, all of them are actually wrapped under the functions. So if we take any of the softwares available, for example, Power BI or Python or R, all of them have functions available for these statistical functions or models. So descriptive is talking about like you can use histogram or plot to understand the data. And for diagnostics to understand what happened, there are many things to do. I mean, for example, regression analysis can be done to understand like what are our variables are affecting my sales. And there are tests like t-test or ANOVA, which can help you understand like what is the confidence that you have in certain variables to predict this outcome. And prediction, it also has methods available, all encapsulated in the algorithms. So I'm not going too deeper into the stats and math behind it, but I'm gonna demo one such example where we're gonna predict something based on a model that we build. I'll go to that next step. So some of the common techniques used in the data analytics are regression models. Regression models usually tell you like, if I have 10 variables, what is the competence of those 10 variables to determine the outcome? And the classification models are there, time series analysis is there, and there are Monte Carlo simulations also there. So there are many such techniques that are commonly used. So I'm using one such technique here, it's called a decision tree. So decision tree will help you understand like, so if I have an example of insurance payments, so it will tell you like, how is your premium depend upon the number of factors, whether he has a ticket, whether he has more activity happening on his account, What is his age? What is his, how many tickets he has in the previous 12 months? I mean, we can all, we can, based on those factors, we can identify whether a certain person should have a higher premium or do have their own, should we have more conditions on his premium, whether an underwriting is required. So for example, there is a live example of this. So one of the insurance companies use these analytical techniques to understand whether underwriting is required for all the insurers, whether it's worth the effort or worth the money that they are that they spend on this underwriting. And then when they did this analysis, they identified that in 85% of the cases, underwriting is not even required. It's straightforward. You can directly give them the premiums and they will be okay. For only 15%, they need to be more, they need to scrutinize more on the driving patterns and then do stricter underwriting. That's one of the things. So I will take an example. So I'm trying to build an model here using the insurance data, and then I will determine whether the new, whether a person needs to be insured or whether he needs to have more conditions applied for his insurance. So I will go to R. I mean, I am using R to build my model, but there are many ways of doing it. So a lot of people use Python. A lot of people use Power BI. I mean, there are many other tools to build these models and demonstrate it. I'm just using R. I mean, for sake of this demo, to get faster, so I have written all these libraries already. So I don't go into why I am using these libraries. It's pretty simple. So, I mean, if you are using Python, you might need to import different libraries so that your plotting and the functions work better. Because all these functions, statistical functions, they are included in packages. And for those packages to work, we need to load those libraries. That's the reason I am using those libraries. So for example, if I see here, I am using two data sets. One is the policy holders and one is policy buyers. I am using policy holders to train my model and then use policy buyers to determine what kind of insurance should I give it to them. So for example, I loaded the policy buyers here, if you see here. So I have a lot of entries here and I have gender, status, what is the account activity, whether he's employed or not, how is he paying, how many tickets he has and everything. And then similarly, I have policy holders here. So if you see for policyholders, it is the insurance categories. It will tell whether it's, we should insure them, whether we should give best terms, whether we should give higher premiums for them. So this is the policyholders. I'm going to train my model using these policyholders, and then I'm going to use this trained data to predict the outcome of the policy buyers. So I'll go back here. So I have a policyholders loaded, and then the... So I am using decision tree here. So decision tree is one such method which can predict that, which can analyze that. This is the diagnostic one. And then we're going to use this for the prediction. So for example, I did this. I use deep tree. What I'm trying to do is like I'm training the model to identify the insurance category based on all these different variables. And then I use summary. And then if you see summary here, what I will tell you is like there are certain elements in the summary. I mean, there are many things here, but I will be focusing on only certain things that will help you understand. So for example, if you see the variable importance, it says what variables are most important to predict the outcome. So for example, tickets within 12 months, age and account activity are three significant factors that will determine the insurance. So that's what our model says. So what we are going to do is like, I mean, I actually visualize this model also here. And if you see the model here, this will tell it if you say account activity is high, yes or no, and whether the ticket account is, if account activity is no, and the ticket, there are no tickets, then we should be giving insurance best terms for that insurance. And who is the high risk insurance here? And for example, do not insure C. If there is high activity, and if there are tickets within 12 months, and if the age is less than 57, we are simply saying do not insure. The model says do not insure. So this is how the model comes up. So what I'm going to do was like, what I did was I used this model, and then apply it on the my policy buyers. So if you see the policy buyers here, my policy buyers doesn't have the insurance category yet. So I'm going to use this model to predict that. So I'll go back to the my script here. So what I will do was like, I mean, there are some, basically what you are doing is like you are reading the policy buyers into your model, and then you are trying to use the predict function and apply the model on the buyers. So when we apply the model on the buyers, it will come something like this. So what it says is, so for each of these account IDs, it will tell you what is the model. So for example, the model says that for this account ID, it says do not insure. And similarly, if we talk about the account ID, some accounts it says insure with high premiums, insure with risk terms. And then there will be items which says insure with best terms. So that's how we're going to use the model to predict the outcomes. I'll go back to presentation because there are some important things that we're going to discuss. So, I mean, this is a summary. So basically what the summary says is like, when you look at the decision tree, the best premiums must be given to the customers who don't have high account activity and doesn't have any ticket within the last 12 months, which makes sense. So that's what the model says. And then we do the same thing to our prediction, I mean, the data that we need to predict. And then if you see here, when we apply the model, I'm going to expand. Sorry, I will. So it says when we apply the model, it says that in our data set, it says that there are 184 customers should be insured with some risk terms, 137 should not be insured at all, 82 customers should be insured with high premiums, and 70 customers should be insured with best terms. So that's how the models are used. I mean, this is a simplistic example with a lot of assumptions, but these decision tree models are really applied on the real examples as well in our insurance companies. That's all I have. I don't think I bore you with so much technical details. I tried to put it more in English terms. Let me know if you have any questions. Stop my presentation.
So Srinivas, did you just actually give us the secrets behind insurance companies and how we get higher premiums or lower premiums?
Yeah, that's what happened.
As long as we don't claim or bother them, we're going to get lower insurance rates.
Yeah, I'm liking if you are younger.
I just hit that mark. I'm over 57, people.
Right?
I qualify there.
So don't claim. Don't bother them.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, I took a simplistic example, but they might be using a lot of advanced techniques other than it, but this is what happens. Well, and I mean,
fantastic showing us the analytics that you've learned. That's awesome. That's really great. I love that.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Any questions?
Just a tidbit, I mean, they cannot use it for the sales because there are laws in many states against price optimization. So they cannot use these kind of models to give you the price. So basically, if I say like based on your social media habits or your history of buying, they cannot determine the price. That's not allowed.
But I mean, something like that would allow you to do like an instant quote like they have on the web. You can just go. And I mean, it's not 100%, but they'll give you an instant quote based on a few pieces of information. And it's that simple model, basically, behind the scenes.
Yep.
Rejects half the people. That's good. Very good. Interesting.
Excellent. Excellent job, everybody. Yes. Thank you very much. Okay. And we do not have David. I'm not sure. But that's it. That's all of our presentations this evening. Thank you. You guys did a great job. And really appreciate, you know, where you guys are coming from with your information. I mean, there's a lot that we get out of these. Looking forward to next week's as well. Thank you, everybody. You guys have a great weekend.
Have a good night, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Good night. Bye, guys.
Thanks.